cocktails and flanked by a traveling pool of reporters, producers, cameramen, and sound technicians, Daron and his distinguished guests exited the chopper and began touring the ash and charred debris. Aside from firemen and security personnel, they were actually the first to walk this historic ground since the day of devastation, and in so doing, they were making headlines. The battle over the future of the Temple Mount was already well underway. The President of Egypt and the King of Jordan had just launched a massive lobbying operation aimed at Washington, Brussels, and the UN Security Council in New York. Their clear objective was to build international pressure on Israel not to take any steps that would change the status quo, such as building a temple, until peace talks with the Palestinians and the rest of the Arab world were completed. Just 2 days before, however, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the largest and most powerful Jewish lobby in the United States, had cranked up its own operation to counter the Egyptian and Jordanian campaign. The status quo had already been changed, they argued, and not by Israel, but by an act of God. What's more, it was time once and for all for the U.S. to acknowledge Jerusalem as the eternal and undivided capital of the Jewish state of Israel, to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, and to allow Israeli democracy to govern the future of the Temple Mount. As he walked across the ruins of what had long been one of the holiest sites in Islam, Ken Costello was acutely aware of the political and religious landmines that lay ahead. It was his job to listen to all sides and bring back a first-hand report to the president. And now, here he was at the vortex of the debate, in the eye of the hurricane. It would be hard to convey to McPherson the visceral sense of loss and devastation he had seen throughout the day, and this moment was no different. But for the soot and ash of the once great historic landmarks that had stood there, there was absolutely no physical evidence that the Dome of the Rock or the Al-Aqsa Mosque had ever existed. "Such was the power of an almighty God," Costello mused, "able to create the world in 6 days and destroy it in one." When they finished their tour, Salvador Lucente gathered reporters around him and held an impromptu press conference at the dead center of the mount. He began by praising Daron and the Israeli people, as well as the entire world community, for banding together to provide medical care, food, and drinking water for those affected by the devastation. He thanked them for their commitment and dedication to working around the clock to bury the dead, despite the enormity of the task. Then he announced that the EU was willing to contribute an additional 1 billion euros to Israel's emergency relief efforts, on top of the 250 million euros the EU had already divided among Israel, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon over the past 3 months. But then, Lucente caught Daron and Costello completely off guard by laying down three conditions for the distribution of such aid. "The European Union is ready to exceed anything we have ever given before, including to the tsunami relief campaign in Asia a number of years ago," Lucente said to the cameras, now beaming the breaking news to the world. "But we also believe the time for peace and reconciliation between Israel and her neighbors has come at last, and we are determined to see a comprehensive resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict as rapidly as humanly possible. We must, therefore, be careful that such large infusions of aid not be allowed to complicate the peace process. As such, we will provide the funds only if my good friend, Prime Minister Daron, and his government commit themselves to three peacemaking steps of goodwill." Costello could only look on with a smile plastered on his face, acting as though he were fully prepared for what was about to happen. But he was not, and expected his cell phone to ring any moment with the president or his chief of staff demanding to know what in the world was going on. "First," Lucente continued, "the EU requests that the State of Israel agree to block any and all efforts by Jews, or by Christians for that matter, to build a Jewish temple on this site, at least for now. This site is, of course, sacred to all three monotheistic religions who call this city home, and its future should be decided in negotiations with all the parties, not unilaterally by one side or the other." Costello could feel his phone vibrating in his jacket pocket. "Second," Lucente went on, "the EU requests that the State of Israel allow the United Nations to assume interim control of the Temple Mount until such final peace talks are complete, so that Jews, Muslims, and Christians can rest assured that their interests in this historically volatile site can and will be handled fairly, impartially, and expeditiously. Third, the EU requests that the State of Israel and the Palestinian Authority, along with their Arab neighbors, commit themselves to completing and signing a final peace treaty within the next 12 months. As the Jewish scriptures say, there is a time for war and a time for peace. There is a time to tear down and a time to build up. There is a time to be silent and a time to speak. And now, I believe, is the time to speak as one world, one voice, for peace, for unity, and for working together to rebuild what was lost. I invite all civilized nations, and particularly our friends in the United States, to join us in ensuring a full and comprehensive settlement to one of the world's most enduring conflicts. Costello knew he was about to be asked to comment on Lucente's demands. The last thing the White House needed was another foreign policy fight with Europe. But was the president prepared to join the EU in blocking emergency aid to Israel unless they knuckled under on an issue as sensitive as the Temple Mount? The only good news for Costello was that Doron would have to answer first, and he knew the Israeli prime minister must be just as startled by Lucente's sucker punch.
"Mr. Prime Minister," shouted a reporter, "how do you respond to the EU's demands?"
Costello found himself impressed by Doron's answer.
"I don't see the foreign minister's remarks as demands, but rather a proposal, and I appreciate it a great deal," the prime minister replied. "Israel remains as committed as always to making peace with our neighbors. We are grateful for the friendship and support of the European Union during this difficult hour, and I look forward to discussing these issues with Mr. Lucente in more detail."
"But, Mr. Prime Minister," shouted another reporter, "polls show that more than 7 in 10 Israelis want you to move forward and build the temple and to do so quickly. In your mind, which is the higher priority, the aid or the temple?"
"I have made no final decision on the future of the Temple Mount," Doron replied calmly. "That's why we are here today, touring the site, discussing options, listening to opinions and proposals from all sides. We will announce our decisions in due course, but let me just say this. There have been two great Jewish temples on this site. The Hebrew prophets tell us there will be another, and I, for one, look forward to that day. It was a European power that destroyed the last temple in A.D. 70, and Jews throughout the world have been praying for almost 2,000 years that such an injustice would be remedied. Today is not the day to decide such questions, but I do believe such a day is not far off."
Chapter 24. Wednesday, January 13th, 12:17 p.m., somewhere over Jordan. They were about 30 kilometers from Amman. But why? With the exception of its largest mosques, which were consumed by the firestorm, the Jordanian capital had largely been spared the wholesale destruction visited upon other Arab capitals like Damascus and Tehran. What could there be to see that was worth all this effort? Dr. Barak soon answered this question.
"In the spring of 1952, something very curious happened," he said, his eyes twinkling with the glee of a professor with a captive and uninitiated audience. "A new scroll was found in Cave 3 in the hills above Qumran, unlike any of the scrolls that had been found before. I was not part of the team that found it, but as a young research assistant, I had the extraordinary privilege of being part of the team that studied it. And believe me, no one had ever seen anything like this scroll. It was not written with ink on animal skins or parchments, as were the others. It was instead engraved on metal, on copper to be precise. But whatever for? If the book of Isaiah, the holy scriptures, mind you, could be written on something so fragile as parchment, what message could the copper scroll possibly contain that was so precious it had to be engraved on metal to be preserved for the ages? This was the first big question we had, but only one of many. Another was, how do we open the blasted thing? It was encrusted with 1,900 years of oxidation. It was so brittle we feared it might disintegrate in our hands. Indeed, unlike any of the other scrolls, it took us 4 years to figure out how to get it open.
So how did you?
Asked Erin, leaning forward in her seat.
Interesting, but not critical,
Barak replied.
I'll explain that later, if you'd like. But the point is, we did get it open in the spring of 1956, and from there, the mystery only deepened. You see, the language of the text was very odd. It wasn't conventional Hebrew or the colloquial Aramaic of the day, but an obscure version of ancient Hebrew, laced with Greek cryptograms, seemingly without purpose. As if that weren't enough, the text itself bore no resemblance to other scrolls. It wasn't a copy of the Jewish scriptures, or a set of religious commentaries, or a journal of daily life in the religious community at Qumran, like we'd found in the other scrolls, and this only baffled us further. Nor was the text of the Copper Scroll even a narrative as the others were. Instead, it contained 64 individual lines or entries, each of which seemed to take us forever to decipher. But as we did, a shockwave began to shake this elite team of archaeologists, linguists, and cryptographers. For each entry described a cache of gold, silver, jewels, or ancient religious artifacts hidden in the surrounding hills. 100 talents of gold here, 50 talents there, 500 talents over there, and so forth. When we tallied it all up, line by line, and translated it into modern weights and measures, the total came to almost 200 tons of treasure. We could hardly believe our eyes.
Was it real or a legend?
Asked Bennett, still unclear how any of this had anything to do with Mordecai's death, but captivated by the tale.
Ah, that's the question, isn't it?
Said Barak.
Some of the team immediately dismissed it all as ancient folklore. How could it be anything but? There was no way, they argued, that a band of monastic Jews living in the Judean wilderness during the first century could possibly have possessed nearly 200 tons of gold and silver, 1/4 of all the known gold and silver in the entire world at the time. But others on the team were convinced it was real. There were certainly massive quantities of gold and silver in Palestine at the time. Biblical and other historical records indicate that the ancient Hebrews had built up enormous reserves of gold and silver and other treasures over the years, all of which they stored in the temple in Jerusalem. 2 Chronicles chapter 9 says, "The weight of the gold that Solomon received yearly was 666 talents. Not including the revenues brought in by merchants and traders. Also, all the kings of Arabia and the governors of the land brought gold and silver to Solomon. Now, just to put that into perspective, 666 talents is about 25 tons of gold and silver, and that came into the temple treasury every year.
But wasn't Solomon's temple destroyed by the Babylonians?
Asked Aaron.
And didn't Nebuchadnezzar cart off all the treasure?
True,
said Barak.
But remember, 70 years later, Nehemiah and Ezra were allowed to return from Babylon to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, restore the temple, and bring back the treasures. They also took up an offering to resupply the temple treasury, and in the process, Ezra collected 18,125 ounces of gold, about half a ton, and 100,000 ounces of silver, roughly 3 tons. Then Ezra chapter 7 notes that the Persian king Artaxerxes issued a decree authorizing that up to 120,000 ounces of silver, almost 4 tons, be given to the Israelites to rebuild the house of the God of heaven.
That's a lot of treasure,
said Bennett.
It certainly is,
Barak agreed.
And the treasures of the Second Temple only grew. King Herod, as you know, dramatically expanded the size of the temple, and Jews annually brought enormous sums of gold, silver, and precious jewels into the temple as part of their tithes and offerings to God. In fact, as you probably know, Jesus himself spoke of the enormity of the temple treasures in Matthew chapter 23, saying, "Woe to you, blind guides! You say, if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred?" Bottom line, everybody in Israel knew how great were the treasures of the second temple. What's interesting to me is that in the years following Jesus' crucifixion, the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem grew more and more worried that the Romans were going to destroy their holy city and take the temple treasures back to Rome, like the Babylonians had done with Solomon's temple. That's what makes the dating of the copper scrolls so intriguing.
Natasha was on approach to Queen Aliyah International Airport, but no one else in the chopper seemed to notice or care.
"As best we can tell,"
Barak continued,
"the copper scroll was written in A.D. 68 or 69. That's just a year or two before the Romans burned Jerusalem and destroyed the temple,"
said Bennett.
"Exactly,"
said Barak.
"And that's when our theory of the copper scroll began to take shape. What if the temple priests had a premonition of what the Romans were about to do? What if they feared the temple treasures would be lost forever if they did not act? What if they began to smuggle the treasures out of the temple at night in small batches, secreting them out of Jerusalem and burying them in the desert sands and the mountain caves to protect them from the coming apocalypse, from what some believed was the coming war of Gog and Magog?"
A moment later, they were back on the ground, stretching their legs. The January air was cool, a slight breeze crossed the desert, and thick winter rain clouds formed overhead. "Come," Natasha said, directing them to a Land Rover parked on the edge of the tarmac. "We should go before the rains begin." They quickly departed the airport grounds and headed to a dusty hill in a suburb of Amman. To their left were the remains of a once great Roman structure of some kind. Six enormous ancient stone pillars stood side by side. The tallest two, in the center, were capped by ornate pieces of carved stone, forming an archway of sorts. But this held little interest for the Baraks. They were already making their way toward an unimpressive little building that seemed more like a small town post office back in the U.S. than the Jordan Archaeological Museum, indicated by a large blue sign over the doorway.
"Finally," Dr. Barak said, using his carved wooden cane and Natasha's assistance to make it up the stone stairway to the front door. "We are here."
The Bennetts followed their hosts into the building and were struck immediately by how different it was from the Israel Museum and the Shrine of the Book.
"Modest, to be sure," Natasha whispered after paying the small entrance fee for them all. "The Jordanians are excellent archaeologists, but unfortunately, they've never had access to the resources necessary to put on a more impressive display."
"I'm not sure I understand," Bennett said. "Why exactly did you bring us here?"
"Because," Natasha whispered, even more quietly this time, "the Jordanians possess one of the greatest artifacts ever found, and they have no idea of its significance."
Dr. Barak was ambling toward the back of the museum. He turned back and motioned that he was about to turn off the main corridor into a smaller exhibit room and that the rest should follow. They did so, and Bennett soon found himself standing amid several glass display cases, none of which appeared to be bulletproof. There were no guards, no surveillance cameras, nor any other monitoring equipment John could detect. Indeed, there was nothing that would indicate that something in this particular room, much less in this entire museum, could even remotely be considered one of the greatest artifacts ever found. Then they turned another corner, and Bennett suddenly realized what he was looking at. The copper scroll itself. Chapter 25. Wednesday, January 14th, 1:46 p.m., Amman, Jordan. It looked nothing like he had expected. For one thing, it didn't look like a scroll at all. Instead of a long sheet or a roll, the scroll was divided into numerous sections or strips, each of which looked to Bennett like a shin guard a child might wear when playing soccer. The segments were each roughly a foot in length and curved upward, evidence that they had once been rolled like a parchment scroll. Each was green with 20 years of oxidation, and each rested on a plastic tray inside these inexpensive glass display cases that would have taken all of about 2 seconds to smash to pieces had they so intended. "Why is it cut up like that?" Bennett asked.
"Remember, when the scroll was first discovered, the whole thing was fused together from oxidation," Barak said. "It took us 4 years, but eventually it was decided that the safest way to open it was to subdivide it."
In a case along the back wall was a wood-framed copper reconstruction of the scroll, to give visitors a sense of what the original may have looked like when it was first made. Beside it were 2 large reconstructed pottery jars.
"Those jars were found in pieces in the same cave as the copper scroll," Natasha pointed out.
Mounted to each of the cases being used to display the pieces of the scroll were several black-and-white photographs. One showed the wrapped sheet of engraved copper, as it had originally looked before being cut into strips. Another showed the entrance to the cave where it was found, guarded by a Jordanian soldier. Yet another showed a picture of the shattered clay jars before they had been reconstructed. On another wall read a fairly bland description of the copper scroll and of the Dead Sea Scrolls in general. It certainly didn't capture the sense of mystery the Baraks had invoked, but there was one curious line that Bennett read aloud to the others. "The copper scroll gives detailed descriptions of 63 treasure troves hidden in Palestine, weighing a total of 160 tons, 10 tons of gold, 80 tons of silver, gold and silver ingots and vases, ritual implements, priestly vestments, etc. All attempts to find this treasure have failed. Some scholars interpret the text as a fable or having symbolic significance." Bennett stopped reading and turned to Dr. Barak. "Question."
"Yes?"
the old man replied. "It says 160 tons of treasure," John noted. "I thought you said there was close to 200 tons.
"Good point," Barak explained. "The scroll itself measures the treasure in talents. The question is, which definition of talent was the writer of the scroll using? Many scholars peg the amount at somewhere between 160 and 175 tons. Others say it's closer to 200. But the truth is, no one knows for sure, because, as the Jordanians note, all attempts to find this treasure have failed."
"Either way, that's a boatload of loot," Bennett quipped.
"It is indeed," Barak agreed. "If anyone were to find it all, the gold and silver alone could be worth at least $2 billion in today's market value. But, of course, its actual religious and historic value is absolutely priceless."
"Okay," said Erin, peering through the glass, studying the scroll as closely as she could. "I've got a question as well."
"Yes, my dear."
"This says there are 63 locations where the treasure's buried, but you said the scroll contains 64 lines of text."
"Ah," Barak sighed, "now we've come to it. Of all the mysteries surrounding the copper scroll, the most fascinating is line 64, for rather than speaking of more treasure, it seems to speak of yet another scroll, one that may unlock the secrets of the first."
Barak reached into his breast pocket and pulled out a photocopy of several pages from a book, an English translation of each line of the copper scroll. He handed it to Erin, who found line 64 and began to read aloud.
"In the tunnel, which is in Sichab, to the north of Kohlit, which opens toward the north and has graves in its entrance, a copy of this text and its explanation and their measurements and the inventory, item by item."
"Ever since we first opened and translated the Copper Scroll in 1956, there has been a raging debate among scholars about the meaning of line 64. Some believe this second scroll is merely a duplicate, an insurance policy of sorts, lest the original was lost or destroyed. But others, myself included, believe the second scroll could actually be the more important of the two. I call it the Key Scroll, because I believe it alone can unlock the mystery of the Copper Scroll. If I'm right, whoever finds the Key Scroll will find the Second Temple treasures, and not a few Jewish scholars believe that when the Second Temple treasures are discovered, it will be time to build the Third Temple.
Does that include you? Asked Aaron.
It does, indeed, Barak said.
Which means you believe their discovery is imminent, Aaron added.
Exactly. And I'm not alone,
said Barak, lowering his voice to a whisper.
Barry Jaspers believed that as well. So did Lionel Mansfield and George Murray. So did Eli. That's why we were working together again after all these years. For just after the earthquake and the firestorm, something remarkable happened. I can't say what, not here at least, not in Jordan. But new information came to us, startling information, and we all believed we were just days away from finding the Key Scroll and thus the treasure. And that's when people started dying.
You think someone is systematically assassinating everyone connected to the Copper Scroll? Aaron asked.
I do, said Barak.
For the money? Asked Bennett.
In part, perhaps, said Barak. As I said, it would be quite a fortune in the hands of any one man or organization. But that's not the most important thing. Something else is at work here.
Like what? Bennett pressed. Barak's eyes scanned the rest of the museum for any sign that someone was listening in on their conversation. Finally, he whispered,
Fear.
Chapter 26. Wednesday, January 14th, 3:30 p.m., Babylon, Iraq.
Mr. President, do you have a moment?
Al-Hassani looked up from a stack of cables he was sifting through and found Khalid Tariq poking his head in the door of his private office.
What is it, Khalid?
Foreign Minister Zheng Zhao has just arrived.
Ah, yes, said Al-Hassani. Show him in.
Al-Hassani greeted the Chinese leader warmly, along with the Chinese ambassador and their translator.
You are very kind to see me, Mr. President. I am very humbled.
It is my pleasure, Mr. Foreign Minister. And please, please come have a seat. You are among friends here. Have you been offered any tea?
Thank you. You are most kind. I understand it is on the way.
Excellent, said Al-Hassani, taking a seat beside Tariq. Now, what can I do for you, gentlemen? I understand you have a problem.
We prefer to think of it as a challenge.
Of course, said Al-Hassani, and an enormous challenge it is. You have just passed Japan as the second largest consumer of petroleum products in the world, and now you're catching up to the Americans quite fast.
This is true, Mr. Zhao replied.
In 1990, I believe you built 700,000 cars, Al-Hassani continued as he lit his pipe. In 2000, you produced 2 million. This year, you'll produce almost 5 million. In just a few short years, you will need 600 million tons of crude oil a year just to keep up with your current economic and population growth rates. And you're wondering where all that oil is going to come from.
I am most impressed, Mr. President. You have certainly done your homework.
You once did business with my country. But then came the UN sanctions, and then came the wars,
Al-Hassani explained, waving off the compliment.
You cut huge deals with the Iranians, but they suddenly find themselves out of business. You signed a massive deal with Russia, but they too are no longer of any help. The Canadians are a possibility, and you've been courting them for years, with some success. But the brutal truth is they aren't producing fast enough, and the oil companies there are in constant battles with environmental groups that seem to care more about porcupine caribou than commerce, which leaves you with two options, the Israelis or us.
We want a deal, the Chinese foreign minister said flatly, and we are prepared to pay handsomely for it.
Very well, said Al-Hassani. Please enlighten me.
Mr. President, I am prepared to talk about more than oil, came Mr. Zhao's reply. I have come to explore the possibilities of forming a military and strategic alliance between China and Iraq.
Al-Hassani's eyes lit up. The Chinese foreign minister finally had his full attention.
What did you mean, fear?
Bennett asked. The foursome had been mostly quiet since leaving the museum. Now Barak looked out the helicopter window at the Jordan Valley below, then back at the Bennetts.
Someone out there is deathly afraid that the temple treasures are about to be discovered, and they should be,
he explained.
Why? Because finding the treasures would provide conclusive historical proof that a Jewish temple once existed, thus sealing not only Israel's legal and historic claim to the Temple Mount, but to Jerusalem as her capital. What's more, if the temple treasures are actually found on land the world calls the West Bank, but which the Bible calls Judea and Samaria, it would powerfully demonstrate that the land was once, in fact, Jewish land, our land, thus undermining the Palestinians' claim to have a state there. Moreover, such a discovery would end any doubt once and for all over whether Israel would rebuild her temple on the site of the first two. We would, and quickly. But that's not all. Religious Jews like myself believe that building the next temple is the prerequisite to the coming of the Messiah, and that when the Messiah finally comes, the judgment of all the nations will begin in full. In other words, we believe what Russia and her allies just went through will pale in comparison to what is coming next. Jewish theology says the worst is yet to come. You Christians believe the same thing, don't you? Don't you believe that building the third temple will trigger the rise of the Antichrist and unleash the Great Tribulation? And then Armageddon? And then the so-called Second Coming?
He was leaving out some important details, but he wasn't that far off.
That's pretty close,
Bennett agreed.
Well, there you have it,
said Barak.
No matter how you look at it, the third Jewish temple brings with it the end of days.
No wonder there are people out there who'll do anything to prevent it from being built,
said Aaron.
Indeed,
said Barak.
You know, for 4 years after the Copper Scroll was found, the Jordanian government did everything it could to keep its very existence under wraps. Even when the New York Times finally broke the story in 1956, Jordanian archaeologists and the royal family insisted that the scroll was a myth, a legend, and that there was no treasure, and thus no link whatsoever to any Jewish temple. In fact, the main reason we haven't rebuilt the temple until now was out of fear that by doing so, we'd unleash a jihad of 1 billion Muslims attacking us for desecrating the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But all that has changed, you see. And now, somebody out there is terrified that with the Dome and the Mosque both gone, plans to rebuild the temple may finally proceed.
Okay, I'm following you,
Bennett said.
But why kill all these Copper Scroll experts now? And why kill Mordecai? Given all that's happened, isn't Israel likely to rebuild the temple now, whether the temple treasures are found or not?
Perhaps,
said Barak.
But there is one issue I have not mentioned yet.
What's that?
Asked Aaron.
I hesitate to bring it up because it's very speculative.
Dr. Barak, please,
said Aaron.
We need to know everything you know if we're going to help track down Dr. Mordecai's killers.
Natasha was bringing the helicopter down on the roof of the Israel Museum.
Well,
Barak said finally,
there are some who believe the Copper Scroll will not only lead us to the Second Temple treasures, but to something far greater as well. Which is what?
Asked Bennett. Barak pulled out his handkerchief again.
The Ark,
he whispered.
The Ark of the Covenant.
Chapter 27. Wednesday, January 14th, 7 p.m., Jerusalem, Israel. Bennett had no interest in dining with Salvador Lucente.
His mind was whirring with all he had heard from the Baraks, and he still had so many questions. Had Mordecai, Barak, and the others really been on the verge of finding the Second Temple treasures? Had they actually found a clue that would have led them to the Ark of the Covenant? Was that really why they had all been murdered? On its face, it all seemed crazy. But in Bennett's experience, anything was possible if it involved Eliezer Mordecai. This wasn't, after all, some cockamamie theory they'd just read in the National Enquirer. It was coming from Israel's highly respected chief archaeologist. It involved three of the world's most renowned archaeologists, each of whom had been murdered or died mysteriously in the span of just a few weeks. What's more, Barak hadn't come to them with his tale. The Prime Minister of Israel had sent them to Barak. Each man involved in the story was advising Daron, and Bennett knew Daron did not suffer fools gladly. But even if it was all true, what exactly was he supposed to do about it? Neither he nor Aaron had time to gather more answers now, so they arranged to meet the Baraks after dinner. Bennett just prayed they would all live that long. It was a strange meeting. The Bennetts had worked with Lucente over the years on the Oil for Peace plan. Together they had hammered out an interim peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians and had cut a deal by which the U.S. and EU would buy a growing percentage of their oil and natural gas from Medexco. But since the Russian-led attack on Israel, they had not spoken to each other at all. It had, after all, been Lucente, now in his 70s, who had helped Russian leader Yuri Gogolov muscle his anti-Israeli resolution through the United Nations, trying to force Israel to give up its strategic weapons in return for NATO membership. What's more, it was Lucente, Bennett had learned recently, who had pressured President McPherson not to come to Israel's defense during the midst of the crisis. And in so doing, Salvador Lucente had earned Bennett's disdain, if not his contempt.
"Jonathan, Aaron, thank you for seeing me. I am so sorry for your loss," Lucente said upon seeing them enter La Regence, the five-star restaurant on the lower level of the King David Hotel. He stood and hugged and kissed them both, though he didn't receive a particularly warm response. "I want you to know I have spoken personally with the head of Interpol and demanded they do whatever possible to hunt down Eli's killers."
"Thank you," said Aaron. "That's very kind."
"It's the least I can do," he said. "I understand you were both with Eli when he passed away. I can only imagine how difficult that must have been."
"We were glad to be able to say goodbye," Bennett said softly as they all took their seats at a small table at the far end of the dining hall. The large room was deserted but for the foreign minister's security detail.
"Prime Minister Daron told me you had a few minutes to speak with Eli before he died. Is that true?"
Bennett nodded.
"Was he lucid?" Lucente asked. "Did he know it was you?"
Bennett took Aaron's hand under the table and squeezed it gently.
"He did," said Bennett. "The doctors were as surprised as we were."
"Could he talk?"
"A little." "What did he say, if you don't mind my asking?"
A waiter came over, poured each a glass of water, and set down a basket of warm rolls, then stepped away. Bennett was grateful for a spare moment to gather his thoughts. He wanted to unleash on this guy for cozying up to Gogolov while Aaron was being tortured in some gulag in Moscow. But something in Aaron's eyes gave him pause. She was trying to remind him that Costello and the president had asked them to take Lucente's temperature and find out what he was up to, and they shouldn't let them down. Bennett shifted in his seat. His personal problems with Lucente would have to wait. "Remarkably, he seemed to be thinking quite clearly, given the circumstances," he answered, pacing himself.
"Really? How so?" asked Lucente.
Bennett took a sip of water, then looked Lucente in the eye and said, "Actually, he told me to watch for the first guy to pressure Israel not to build her temple." "Guess he meant you." That raised Lucente's bushy gray eyebrows in a hurry.
"You don't say," the foreign minister replied, scrambling for a comeback. "Actually, I would think you would be the first one to agree with me, Jonathan."
"Why?" asked Bennett.
"Well, to be quite candid, I'm not opposed to the Jews building their temple, not per se," said Lucente, splitting open a freshly baked roll. "But my main interest, as I thought, was yours,
was finding a way to conclude a peace treaty between Israel and her neighbors once and for all. And toward that end, a unilateral move like seizing the Temple Mount doesn't seem very peace-inducing, does it? In his previous job as the president's senior advisor on the Arab-Israeli peace process, Bennett very likely would have agreed, or been required to by his boss back at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But his perspective, and thus his allegiances, had been shifting, and not toward Europe. Before he could answer, however, Aaron cut in. "To what exactly do we owe the honor of a meal with you, Mr. Foreign Minister?" she asked, cool, though not quite impolite. Lucente, however, was startled. "Well, I thought we might ease into the pool a bit more, but if you would like to dive in..." He reached down to open his briefcase and fished out a letter-sized envelope. Bennett noticed it had the distinctive blue-and-white United Nations logo on the front. "Well, then, yes," Lucente began, clearly thrown off his game plan by Aaron's abrupt question. "Yes, well, as you both no doubt know, the Secretary-General's term in office expired on the 1st of January." "We know," said Aaron, "and President Mugabe of South Africa is set to replace him, if I'm not mistaken."
"Actually, I'm afraid you are," said Lucente.
"What do you mean?"
"There's been a change."
"I haven't heard anything," Bennett said.
"Then again, you've been on your honeymoon," Lucente smiled.
"Nevertheless," said Aaron, "we would have heard about a change like that."
"Which is why we're breaking bread together tonight," Lucente said. "It has just come up."
He handed over the sealed envelope labeled Private and Confidential for the President of the United States.
"What is this?" asked John.
"It's a handwritten letter from Secretary General Pipilo. It explains that President Mugabe has been diagnosed with liver cancer. It appears to be terminal. That is why he has been in the hospital the past few weeks, delaying the January 1st transition. President Mugabe has, therefore, changed his mind. He is not going to serve, and the Secretary General intends to nominate me to be his replacement." Neither of the Bennetts could believe what they were hearing. For the last several years, Lucente had been engineering a new foreign policy for the European Union that diverged sharply from American interests and threatened to rip the NATO alliance to shreds. He had been bad enough to deal with in his current role. As Secretary General, he could make life extremely difficult for Washington.
"I have the votes," Lucente said after a moment, sensing their reactions. "It would be a mistake for the president to oppose me."
"It is no longer our concern," said Bennett. "We don't work for the president, and we no longer advise him on such matters. But you know that. You could have told him directly, or Secretary Warner, or Marcia Kirkpatrick. Why us? Why tonight?"
"Because I'd like to hire you," Lucente replied.
"Both of us?" Bennett asked, taken aback.
"I want both of you to serve on my senior team."
"To do what?" asked Aaron.
"To help me finalize the peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians," Lucente explained.
"It's almost done, as you know, but we need to finish it off quickly."
"And?"
"And I want you to hammer out a treaty between Israel and Iraq."
Bennett looked at Aaron. "What kind of treaty?"
"Full peace, full recognition, full economic and diplomatic ties," said Lucente.
"Think about it.
The Israelis and Iraqis are now the biggest oil producers in the world. They're making money hand over fist. The last thing we need is for either of them to start an arms race or square off against the other. One more price spike, and the global economy will collapse."
Bennett mulled that for a moment.
"I imagine Daron would love to cut a peace deal with Iraq," he agreed. "But would al-Hassani agree? I don't know."
"I think he would, Jonathan," said Lucente.
"Al-Hassani is poised to become the oil kingpin of the Middle East. He wants permission to rebuild the oil infrastructure in Iran, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, and the former Soviet republics, and to run them himself. He also wants Russia's seat on the UN Security Council. I'll give him both tomorrow, but not unless he signs a full peace treaty with Israel. That's why I'm headed to Babylon. I just wish you two were coming with me. Think about it, and I'll call you when I get back to Brussels."
Chapter 28.
Wednesday, January 14th, 11:13 p.m., Jerusalem, Israel. It was just after 11 when they finally reconnected. The two Bennetts and the two Baraks met at a little cafe called Keshet in the heart of the Jewish quarter of the Old City. Normally, the cafe closed at 9, but the couple who owned it was meeting with their accountant to go over their tax returns, and when Dr. Barak, an old friend, showed up, they happily put on some coffee and brought out baklava. It was a quiet, charming little place with wooden tables and chairs. On a hot summer night, they could probably accommodate upward of 50 patrons, but this, of course, was the middle of January, and though it was unseasonably mild, the quarter was deserted. Bennett suggested they meet inside, but Barak insisted he needed the fresh air. Besides, he saw no point in letting the owners or their accountant overhear their discussion. So the four of them dragged their chairs out to one of the outdoor tables and made themselves at home. Barak rested his cane against the table and took a seat with his back to the cafe, eager to enjoy the quiet of a large courtyard to his left, typically filled with the laughter of little children, mothers chatting with neighbors, and yeshiva students arguing over some obscure Torah passage. Natasha took a seat beside him, while John and Aaron sat across from them, soaking up their surroundings as well. For all their travels to this holy city, they had never had the time to be tourists, and thus had never strolled along these stone streets, like so many young lovers had through the ages. Behind them was a branch of the Mizraim Bank, Bennett noticed, which was good, because he needed to use the ATM before they headed back to the King David. A sign next to the bank pointed the way to a short walk to the western wall. He thought he might like to take Aaron down there if they didn't finish up too late. They certainly had a lot to pray about, and what better place than the wall? To Bennett's immediate right was a colonnade that led to the Cardo Center, the Arab market, and the heart of the Muslim quarter, not a route he thought would be best tonight, but one that would actually be quite interesting during the day. For now, though, they were being served piping hot Turkish coffee and a generous spread of fruit and nuts and sweets, and Barak was clearly itching to pick up his story where he'd left off.
"Ever hear of a man named Abdullah Farouk?" the old man said when they were alone again. Neither John nor Aaron had. "He's a Saudi prince," Barak explained. "He's been hunting for the Ark for years and has poured millions of dollars into the quest. He's absolutely obsessed with the idea that the Copper Scroll is the key to finding the Ark, and he's terrified that the Jews will get to it first. His family thinks he's crazy, but that's what makes him so dangerous. He's rich, and he's driven, and he simply won't give up. According to Eli, Farouk has had ties with all kinds of terrorist groups over the year. Hezbollah, Hamas, Al-Qaeda, and more recently, Al-Nakba. Basically, he'll give enormous sums of money to anyone committed to driving the Jews into the sea and to keeping Israel from ever finding the Ark."
Barak reached into his briefcase and pulled out a clipping from a London-based Saudi-financed newspaper. He handed it to Bennett. "Prince pledges millions to Ark Quest," read the headline, dated 6 years earlier. With Aaron looking over his shoulder, John scanned the story and came to a quote highlighted in yellow, which he read aloud. "People don't understand," Farouk explained over a cup of tea in a mosque outside of London. "This isn't about finding some dusty old relic for a museum. It's about finding the first weapon of mass destruction. Laugh if you want, but what if the legends are true? Have you read the ancient manuscripts? In their original languages? The Ark killed tens of thousands. It shattered enemy cities. It leveled entire armies. What if the Zionists find it first? It would make them invincible. They could control all of Palestine. They could seize Mecca and Medina. They could dominate all of the Muslim lands, and there would be nothing we could do to stop them. Then again, imagine if I found it first. What if the very power of Allah was in our hands? It is we who would be unstoppable. Not only could we destroy the Jews, but we could build an Islamic caliphate that would rule the world." Bennett took another sip of coffee. "This Farouk guy has been watching a little too much Raiders of the Lost Ark, don't you think?" "I'll say," Aaron laughed, "a classic fanatic." Bennett noticed the old man's hesitation. "You don't think he's nuts?"
"I said he's obsessed, but not crazy," Barak explained. "There's a difference. But either way, it makes him dangerous.
So you think he might be behind these killings? Said Aaron.
I do, Barak confirmed.
There was something in the way he answered that made Bennett uncomfortable. It's more than that, isn't it? He asked, setting his coffee down and staring into Barak's eyes. You believe him, don't you?
I didn't say that, Barak demurred.
You think the Ark actually has some sort of supernatural powers, don't you? Bennett pressed.
Don't you?
Barak replied. Bennett said nothing for a moment, nor did Natasha or Aaron.
Look, Jonathan, Barak explained, there is no one in Israel who has studied the history of the Ark more carefully than I have. Yet there is so much we don't know. No one has seen the Ark in almost 3,000 years. It is surrounded by mysteries and legends. Who among us can separate fact from fiction at this point? But there is one point upon which the Holy Scriptures could not be more clear. The Ark is an object of tremendous power, mystical power. It is to be feared, not dismissed. Men who were careless about its fearsome power died instantly. Those who touched it improperly died instantly.
Come on, Dr. Barak, really, said Bennett. I'm a Christian. I believe what the Bible says about the Ark. But as you said yourself, that was thousands of years ago.
Jonathan, you are new to all this, I realize. Thus, you have a luxury I dare not share, cynicism. But you should know that Eli Mordecai understood the significance of the Ark. What's more, he understood the stakes should the Ark fall into the hands of a man like Abdullah Farouk. He gave up his life to prevent that from happening, so perhaps you should not be so cavalier. Perhaps you should...
A shot rang out. Barak snapped back in his chair and fell to the ground. Natasha screamed as blood oozed from the old man's mouth. Another shot went wild, shattering the cafe's plate glass window. John and Aaron dove for cover as more shots ripped through windows and walls. Natasha was on the ground, her arms wrapped around her grandfather. She was still screaming, her hands shaking uncontrollably. For a split second, the shooting stopped. Bennett guessed the shooter was reloading. Aaron grabbed Natasha and pulled her to safety while Bennett rushed to Barak's side to check his pulse. There was none. Suddenly, he heard Aaron shouting, "John, get down!" He could see a shadow moving on a fourth-floor balcony across the courtyard. Then Aaron was there, Beretta in hand. She opened fire. "John, now go!" she yelled. Bennett made his move. He grabbed Natasha by her arms and literally dragged her into the stone colonnade, behind the cafe and out of the line of fire. She was kicking and swinging at him and stronger than Bennett had expected.
"Let me go!" she screamed. "Let me die with him!"
But there was no way Bennett was going to let that happen. Natasha Barak was now the only link they had to the secrets of the scrolls and the men willing to kill for them. Chapter 29. Thursday, January 15th, 12:01 a.m., Jerusalem, Israel. Bennett shielded Natasha with his own body. Aaron shot back at their assailants until she had fired her last round. A moment later, she dove into the colonnade as more automatic gunfire tore up the cafe. The shooter or shooters didn't have a clear shot at them now, but they didn't seem to care. They were firing at anything and everything that moved. Aaron glanced into the cafe through a side door as she reloaded her Beretta. Then she disappeared inside. Bennett had no idea what she was doing, but he didn't dare call out to ask. Instead, he grabbed Natasha's chin and squeezed until her frightened eyes focused on his. "You can't stay here," he said through gritted teeth. "They'll kill you, and we need you." Natasha was shaking, but she hadn't slipped into shock, not yet. Aaron reemerged from the cafe with an Uzi in her hand. It was covered with blood. "Everyone in there's dead," she said as she handed over the machine gun and some ammo. "I found this inside." Suddenly, they could hear men running and shouting in Arabic. Whoever was hunting them, they were coming fast. "We need to move, now," Bennett ordered. "Follow me." He held the gun in one hand, grabbed Natasha with the other, and sprinted down the colonnade toward the Muslim quarter. They scrambled down some stairs, took a sharp left, and entered the Arab market.
During the day, these narrow stone streets were bustling with shoppers buying spices or electronics or shoes or bread, and old men haggling over prices, playing backgammon, and smoking their water pipes. But they were deserted now. The shoppers were gone. The shops were closed, their metal shutters pulled down and locked for the night. A burst of automatic gunfire let loose over Bennett's shoulder as they whipped around another corner and headed deeper into the souk. He could hear the rounds pelting into the stone walls behind him, but didn't dare look back. He hugged the Uzi tight to his chest and wrapped the strap around his neck and shoulder. He would use it only as a last resort, he decided. Then he realized he'd never checked the magazine. Was it even loaded? How many rounds did he have left, if any? Another burst of gunfire. The shooters were gaining ground. Bennett rounded another corner, quickly handed Natasha off to Aaron, and told them to keep running. Then he backed into the shadows and dropped to the ground. He could see two masked men coming at him full steam, but for the moment they couldn't see him. He steadied the Uzi, took aim, and when they got close, he pulled the trigger and didn't let go. Fire poured from the end of the weapon. The two men dropped to the ground, careening down the narrow passageway and coming to a stop not far from where he was hiding. And suddenly, all was quiet. Bennett could hear his heart pounding. He knew how close to death he had just come. He climbed to his feet and carefully peered around the corner. No one else was coming, and he breathed a sigh of relief. Until he heard Aaron scream, "John, look out!" Startled, Bennett swung around to see one of his injured assailants groping for his AK-47. But before he could fire, Aaron kicked away the man's gun and smashed his head against the stones. Then she ripped off his mask, jammed her Beretta in his left temple, and growled at him in Arabic. He smiled, but said nothing. She slammed his head against the rock a second time and again jammed her Beretta into his temple. It wasn't working. Blood was running from the man's ears and mouth. His eyes were glassy. What little life was still within him was quickly draining away. She wasn't going to get whatever information she had hoped to extract from him. Sure enough, a moment later, he was dead. Bennett peeked back around the corner. They were still alone, but they wouldn't be for long. Aaron, meanwhile, moved to the second man and checked his pulse. He, too, was dead. She checked their pockets for any bit of identification, but came up empty. "Two John Does," she said, "but they knew right where to find us."
"How?"
asked Natasha, her body trembling and covered with sweat. That wasn't a topic Bennett wanted to cover just yet. "We need to keep moving," he insisted. "Whoever these guys are, they've got better intel than we do. We're sitting ducks if we stay here."
"Where should we go?" Aaron asked. "We can't take her back to her flat. They'll kill her. And we can't go back to the King David either. They obviously know we're with her."
"What are you two talking about?" Natasha demanded. "Just call the police. Tell them what happened. Call the Prime Minister. He'll give us anything we need."
"We can't," said Aaron.
She stuffed her Beretta into her back pocket and put her arm around Natasha, trying to calm her down.
"We think there's a mole in Daron's office. No one else knew we'd be meeting you tonight but Daron and his top staff."
"Why? Why are they doing this to us?" Natasha cried.
Aaron's hand shot to Natasha's mouth, trying to keep her quiet without terrifying her all the more.
"Your grandfather just told us why. But now you've got to believe us. You're not safe in Israel, not anymore. And neither are we. We've got to find a way to get you out of the country. It's too dangerous."
"Aaron, really, we need to get moving," said Bennett. Aaron turned to Natasha and stared into her eyes.
"Think, Natasha. Do you know anyone in the old city? Anyone we could stay with overnight until we sort things out?"
Natasha tried, but it was clear her emotions were getting the best of her.
"My sister-in-law, she and my brother, they..."
"No," said Aaron, "no family, no close friends, somewhere no one would know to look. It has to be someone you know but not well, someone who will take us in without turning us in." Natasha said suddenly,
"I've got it. Come on, this way."
Bennett and Aaron looked at each other, but did not say a word. They could hear sirens rapidly approaching. They had no choice and no time. They had to trust Natasha and hope for the best. So they each grabbed an AK-47 and extra ammo and followed Natasha deeper inside the Muslim quarter. Dogs were barking. People were awakening to the commotion. Lights were coming on in every home, and Bennett knew that if they did not get off the streets quickly, they could easily get cornered by an angry mob or by an Israeli patrol, and for the moment he wasn't sure which was worse. Were they really being hunted by forces bought and paid for by Abdullah Farouk, or by a fifth column inside the Israeli government, possibly run by a mole deep inside Prime Minister Daron's own office? Who were their allies? Whom could they trust? Cautiously, they worked their way down Aqabat El Sariah Street, expecting an ambush at every door and alleyway, but so far it had been clear. When they got to El Wad Road, Natasha poked her head around the corner. Then she turned back and motioned that they were taking a left, and no sooner had they done this than they came upon a set of stairs leading to a small apartment. It was surrounded by fencing and barbed wire, and an Israeli flag was draped over one window. Natasha headed up two steps at a time.
"Where are we?" Bennett whispered, scanning the rooftops around them for any signs of danger. "My friends Ori and Laila Shokat live here," Natasha whispered back. "Their daughter, Sarah, was a student of mine at the university."
"How long ago?"
3-4 years, maybe."
"You trust them?"
"They're political Zionists, not religious ones," Natasha replied. "Believe me, if they hate you, it'll be over your peace deal with the Arabs, not over Jesus."
"And you're sure they still live here?"
"Absolutely," said Natasha. "When Jews move into the Muslim quarter, they don't leave unless they're in a body bag."
Natasha turned and buzzed the intercom. She spoke for a moment with a man in Hebrew, then held her breath. Seconds passed. Then a minute. No reply. Bennett's heart was racing. Whoever was in there was A, consulting with his family, B, finding his gun, or C, calling the police. Whichever, time was running out. He could hear people spilling out on the streets, shouting in Arabic. He wiped his hands on his pants, then tightened his grip on the machine gun and checked on Aaron, now guarding Natasha's back. She was okay for the moment, but he didn't want her out in the open a minute more than necessary. And then the electronic locks on the door clicked open. They were in. Chapter 30. Thursday, January 15th, 12:56 a.m., Jerusalem, Israel. The Shokats didn't know what to say at first. They were obviously surprised to see Natasha at their door at this late hour, but they were clearly worried about her, too. Natasha suddenly seemed dazed and incoherent, and Bennett realized she was going into shock. Aaron quickly explained that they were friends of Natasha's from the U.S., that there had been a series of shootings in the Arab market, and that they weren't convinced there was a safe way out of the quarter just now. She also explained that Natasha thought the Shokats were the only people they could all turn to, and that's why they were here. For now, Bennett noticed, she chose not to tell them that Natasha's grandfather had just been shot, or that they were on the run. It was just as well. Aaron apologized for inconveniencing them, but the Shokats wouldn't hear of it. They had seen John and Aaron's face on the news for years, they said. It would be an honor to protect them for the night.
"You'll be safe with us," said Mr. Shokat, his Uzi in hand. "I'll make sure of it."
"Thank you, Mr. Shokat," Bennett replied, shaking his hand. "We really appreciate it. Please, please, call me Ori." Natasha began to worsen. She slumped down on the living room couch and started to shake. Mrs. Shokat ran to get blankets to wrap around her, and then she led them all into the basement, opened two fold-out couches, and gave them clean sheets, towels, blankets, and pillows. Aaron tucked Natasha in and took her vital signs. After a few minutes, Natasha began to relax a bit, and soon she was fast asleep.
"Perhaps I should let you all get some rest," said Mrs. Shokat. "We can talk in the morning. Is there anything else you need?"
"Actually, there is," said Bennett apologetically.
"You wouldn't happen to have a computer we could use for a few minutes, would you?"
"Of course, in the corner," the woman replied, "with wireless access if you need it."
She showed them how to get it started, then gave Natasha a kiss on the forehead, said goodnight, and went back upstairs to bed. Bennett stepped into the bathroom. He closed the door and pulled out his cell phone. The first thing he did was call his mom. He got voicemail and breathed a guilty sigh of relief. They had much to talk about, but now was not the time. "You're going to hear some terrible things on the news," he explained. "We're okay. We're safe. I can't tell you everything just now. I just need you to pray for us, Mom. That would mean a lot to me. I'll call you when I can. I love you. Bye." Next, he speed-dialed Ken Costello. "Ken, it's John. I'm sorry if I woke you up.
Are you kidding?
Asked Costello.
I've been on the phone the last half hour with the ambassador. Langley, Foggy Bottom, the Situation Room. I'm watching the coverage right now on Channel 2.
Are you still at the King David?
For a few more minutes,
Costello replied.
They're sending a car from the consulate in East Jerusalem. Kirkpatrick wants me to monitor the situation from there. But what about you? Where are you? Are you okay?
I'm fine, said Bennett, but I need a favor.
Sure, what's up?
Ever heard of a guy named Abdullah Farouk?
Can't say I have.
Get whatever state and the FBI have on this guy and email it to my BlackBerry.
Why? Is he involved in this thing?
I'll explain later, but it's urgent. Fast as you can.
No problem,
said Costello.
What about Rajiv at CIA?
Aaron's about to call her, Bennett said.
And Aviza Doc at Mossad?
Asked Costello. No, we haven't tried him yet.
Why not?
Bennett hesitated for a moment, but then realized he didn't have much choice. He explained their growing fears of a high-level penetration inside the drone inner circle.
A double agent inside the Prime Minister's office?
Said Costello.
Come on, John, that's crazy.
Bennett conceded that